We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future, on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio, November 8, 2015. Here on the Dark Matter Digital Network every Saturday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. And we have a great show for you here tonight. We're going to try some different things on the show. You're always welcome to contact me, Brian@AfterDarkRadioShow.com, Twitter at Brian Alvarez. Let me know what you think of the new format of the show and the guest tonight and everything else.
You know, she was sitting there, but there was something very wrong with her. She was marked up. She had around her neck. She was bruised around her neck where they tried choking her.
Stephen LaChance is the author of The Uninvited, the true story of the Union Screaming House. In this true and terrifying firsthand account, Stephen LaChance reveals how he and his three children were driven from their Union, Missouri home by demonic attackers. LaChance chronicles how the house's relentless supernatural predators infest those around them. He consults paranormal investigators, psychics, and priests, but the demonic attacks, screams, growls, putrid odors, invisible shoves, bites, and other physical violations only grow worse. The entities clearly demonstrate their wrath and power, killing family pets, sexually assaulting individuals, even causing two people to be institutionalized. The demon's next target is the current homeowner, Helen. When the entities take possession and urge Helen toward murder and madness, LaChance must engage in a hair-raising battle for her soul. The Uninvited, the true story of the Union Screaming House, was selected as one of the best books of 2008 by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Stephen LaChance will be our guest on the program tonight.
What is that?
Oh my God!
What?
This is scary!
It's like,
oh my God!
Hollywood was abuzz last night with reports of a missile-shaped UFO over Los Angeles. A bluish-green comet-like object was spotted from the Pacific Coast all the way east to Nevada. Even the Kardashians were tweeting about it. Khloe Kardashian tweeted, "UFOs are real. Tripping out. Kendall and I are spazzing out. #UFO. Kendall Jenner also tweeted, "Khloe and I are freaking out right now over this UFO situation." All sorts of actors, comedians, etc. were tweeting about the UFO last night. But alas, at least officially, it was not a UFO. The San Diego Union Tribune reports, quote, "Navy Strategic Systems Programs conducted the scheduled Trident II missile test flight at sea from the Kentucky, an Ohio-based ballistic missile submarine, in the Pacific Test Range off the coast of Southern California. The test was part of a scheduled ongoing system evaluation test," said Commander Ryan Perry with the Navy's 3rd Fleet. Perry said launches are conducted on a frequent, recurring basis to ensure the continued reliability of the system. Each test activity provides valuable information about our systems, thus contributing to assurance in our capabilities, he said in a statement. It may not be the last sighting this week. LAX issued a statement prior to the sighting which read, quote, the military airspace to the west of LAX will be active for 1 week, creating traffic route limitations and requiring LAX to temporarily deviate from our over-ocean operations. Scientists rule out presence of huge alien megastructure orbiting a distant star, writes Nicola Harley in the UK Telegraph. The dimming of a star, which had led to concerns large alien structures could be shadowing it, is now believed to be the result of a natural phenomenon, experts say. The SETI Institute, which searches for extraterrestrial intelligence, has been investigating the possibility of an alien civilization. Seth Shostak, a veteran searcher for alien life at the SETI Institute, says this suggests a natural phenomenon rather than the suggestion of alien life. A scientific survey of the KIC 8462852 star system, which is 1,500 light-years from Earth, was seeking to determine what had been causing it to dim. There had been discussions that the occasional dimming could be being caused by an alien megastructure occasionally blocking the light. The investigation saw scientists searching for the existence of radio signals, which may suggest the existence of alien life. It has now ruled out the existence of two types of radio signals, which could indicate the presence of aliens who are either trying to communicate across space or who may be using spacecraft powered by intense microwave beams. The Kepler Space Telescope had picked up signs that the star system had dimmed on occasions by up to 20%. SETI had considered one possibility was that a technologically adept civilization had built megastructures in orbit around the star, causing the dimming. For example, with a large-scale astro-engineering project, it has trained its Allen Telescope Array on the star for more than 2 weeks. SETI says analysis of the array data shows no clear evidence for either type of signal between the frequencies of 1 and 10 gigahertz. The group is going to continue monitoring the situation.
Yeah, well, the pyramids were made in a way that they had hermetically sealed compartments. You wouldn't need hermetically sealed compartments for a sepulcher. You would need that if you were trying to preserve grain over a long period of time.
That's presidential candidate Ben Carson. According to Tom Head in an article at mysteriousuniverse.org, we have ample evidence that this is not the case. Number one, he says, it's pretty clear the pyramids contained human remains. Number two, the pyramids were built over a very long period of time. Number three, the pyramids identify themselves as tombs. Number four, the pyramids weren't even hollow. And number five, the Bible doesn't even remotely imply that Joseph built the pyramids. Whatever secrets the pyramids hold, we may soon discover, as the Times of India reports a group of Egyptian and foreign experts launched Sunday a new bid to unravel the secrets of the pyramids, including a search for hidden chambers inside four famed pharaonic monuments. An article linked up at artbell.com notes that architects and scientists from Egypt, France, Canada, and Japan will use modern infrared technology and advanced detectors to map two pyramids at Giza and the Tur Dashur Pyramid south of Cairo. The special group will study these pyramids to see whether there are still any hidden chambers or other secrets inside them, said the Minister of Antiquities, Mamda al-Damadi, at a news conference. These engineers and architects will conduct the survey using non-destructive technology that will not harm the pyramids. Experts say the study, known as Scan Pyramids, will also be a fresh attempt to understand how the monuments were built in the first place. Many previous missions have attempted to unravel the mysteries of the pyramids, but archaeologists and scientists have yet to come up with a concrete theory explaining how the structures were built. A man who claims he assassinated President John F. Kennedy has been moved this week from a high-security jail to a less secure one in Illinois in preparation for his release next spring after 36 years behind bars, reports the Daily Mail in the UK. James Files, 72, says that he was the man on the grassy knoll back on November 22, 1963, and that he fired the bullet in Kennedy's head that ultimately killed him. Now the CIA and other U.S. secret agencies are preparing for scores of conspiracy theories as Files identifies himself yet again as the missing piece of the Kennedy story. Files says the other shot that hit Kennedy came from his boss, Charles Chucky Nicoletti, who was hiding out in the book depository, the same place Lee Harvey Oswald is believed to have been, at the time of the shooting. The Sunday Express reports that Files claims there was a conspiracy between the Mafia and the CIA to kill Kennedy. Such claims could lead to Files being called to Washington to give a testimony under oath. Files was a Vietnam War veteran who was also part of a team that trained a militia for the unsuccessful Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. He said that many in the CIA turned against Kennedy when he called for a stop of the secret operation. Files was kicked out of the military and became the right-hand man to Chicago Mafia chief Charles Chucky Nicoletti, who was a hitman for Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana. Files, who is currently serving time for being an accessory incident, and feared Kennedy was going to shut down the agency. He claims the CIA called in mobsters to carry out a killing in Dallas. At least one former FBI agent, Zach Shelton, believes Files' story, including the location from which he shot Kennedy. I have tried to verify Files' story. A lot of that story I have been able to verify, says Shelton. But five government investigations since the assassination have determined it was Oswald who shot Kennedy. Assassination expert and author Matthew Smith said, quote, I have always thought there were two shooters on the grassy knoll. I have no doubt the CIA was involved. Vincent Bugliosi, in his book Reclaiming History, disagrees. For years, Bugliosi writes, Files has been begging people to believe that he killed Kennedy, but with a few exceptions, no one, not even those on the fringes of the conspiracy community, respect him or his story. Indeed, Files has fallen on such hard times that few buffs will even talk to him. James Files describes what he says happened in a new documentary that aired on Newsmax TV, I Killed JFK. In a moment, Stephen LaChance, the author of The Uninvited, the true story of the Union Screaming House, here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network every Sunday night, live 9 o'clock p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. And we are very happy to be today to be joined by Stephen LaChance. We're going to be talking a number of topics, including his book, The Uninvited, The True Story of the Union Screaming House. And Stephen, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
You know what's funny is we were scheduled to do this show about 10 minutes ago, but I called you 10 minutes late. And when I called you, I alerted you that there had been a disaster here. And
right.
The disaster was somebody came over and left a bag of Ritz crackers or something out, and my cats found them and ate them. And it's just a complete mess everywhere. And as soon as I told you about this disaster, it suddenly entered my mind, I'm talking to Stephen LaChance. This is not a disaster here in my house. There are much bigger disasters that could occur, and they occurred, and we're going to talk about them here on this show today. The Union Screaming House. That is a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start.
Yeah, of great proportions, I would say.
Biblical. That's a good way to put it. Let's start at the beginning here. The book. Tell us the process of writing this book and what made you decide to put this all down on paper.
Well, you know, I the first thing I did was a haunting came along and he asked me to do the show. And I went ahead and did it. And I sat down and I watched it. And it was great for what it was. It was 48 minutes. But I realized within 48 minutes, you could not possibly tell it all. And I had a friend of mine come up and say, you know, you really need to write a book on this. And I said, well, no, not really. I kind of resisted. because, first of all, it was going to bring up a lot of old feelings and such. But finally, one day, I sat down at the computer one afternoon, and a month later, the book was done. As I started writing it, I realized that I needed to get this out in some way. So, you know, it was more of an exercise in some ways of healing than anything. And then I got it out, and, you know, it was better in some ways.
There is a big warning at the beginning of the book about how if you're sitting here reading this and you feel like you're alone, are you really alone? Does it feel like there's somebody breathing down your neck, et cetera, et cetera? It was very creepy to read this in the middle of the night, I will add that. And, I mean, did you, It is the old saying, it feels like someone is breathing down my neck. It feels like somebody is watching me. And realistically, I'm sure 99 times out of 100, it is just paranoia. And maybe you experienced something that like that in your life before all of this occurred. Is there a difference between feeling like somebody is breathing down your neck and realizing that, oh my God, something actually is breathing down my neck?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that there definitely is. I mean, when you're sitting in a room and you hear that breathing right next to your ear. And he used to breathe. When it would breathe, it would be a very labored breathing, so it was very heavy, so there was no mistaking it. And others would hear it as well at the same time. But, you know, so that brought about the question in my own mind, and what you were reading there was actually how I was feeling at that moment, with that realization that we're not alone, that there are other things in this world we don't understand, and, you know, to take away your privacy from you in that sense, to feel that at any given point there could be this other thing in the room with you that you don't know is there. It was, to me, very frightening. It was disturbing. I don't know how else to put it in any other words other than that. So that's what that was about. It was what I was feeling at that moment, in that time, in that place, was dealing with those feelings like, you know, there is a possibility that I'm never alone. And, you know, I could be sitting here right now and I could be talking to you and I could have this thing over my shoulder. And I might not even be able to see what it is, and God only knows what it might be. You know, after that feeling of actually going through that, where you would have that breathing.
Let's start at the beginning here. It was May of 2001, and you needed to find a place to live, and you stumbled upon this house in Union, Missouri. Let's start there.
Well, we were living in an apartment at the time, and I was a single dad. I had three children. We'd look out onto a parking lot from a balcony, was basically the yard that we had. And I realized the kids were getting to an age and such that I needed to find a place where they could play. I wasn't going to put them out in the street to play. So I went looking for a house, and that is the reason I went to find the house. And I found this house. It was an old house. You know what? The thing is looking back at it now, it reminded me of my grandmother's house when I was a kid. So I was, instantly there was a bad attraction, I would think, for good memories. You know, you do that in life. And so I went ahead and I rented the house, and we moved into it on May 18th of 2001.
So I guess the first question here would be, I have a friend, he was just telling me the story yesterday. We were talking about hauntings, and I don't know if he believes in ghosts or anything like that, but he mentioned that whatever the situation was, he and his family and his friends or whatever, they visited this house, and he says, I walked into this room, and I looked up, and there was a row of porcelain dolls. And he says, I got the hell out of there as fast as I could, because whether he believed in ghosts or not, this was too creepy for him. When you first stepped into this house, was there anything that raised a red flag? Was there anything that you found disconcerting, or did it seem like a perfectly...
Well, I thought strange. I mean, not disconcerting or anything, but the thing that I found strange from entering in the front door was there was a border of cherubs above the wall, around the top of the wall. And I thought that was a little strange. I mean, it looked, I don't know how else to say this, but, you know, when the first time I saw it, I thought it kind of looks like a funeral home. You know, other than that, I mean, there was the smell of cookies baking. I mean, it smelled like someone had been baking cookies in the house, which was kind of nice. You know, looking in the basement, it was more, the landlord was more strange than anything. That was the thing that I found more disturbing than anything, I guess, looking back now, was the way the house was presented. It was presented almost like it was a museum piece or something along those lines.
She asked you a question, something along the lines of, are you prepared for the responsibility? And you weren't sure what to make of this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the question was, are you prepared for the responsibility that comes with living in an old house like this?
Sure.
You know, and I thought to myself, you know...
That could mean a lot of things.
You know, yeah, you know, I, you know, like taking care of it because it's an older house, that's not a problem. You know, the thing is that moment when that question was asked, I never would have thought that it could have meant something along these lines or something a little bit more diabolical in a sense, I guess. You know, it just, that didn't ever enter my mind. I mean, it wasn't part of my daily life, number one. Number two, I really never really considered it. It wasn't really that I was a skeptic of sorts. It's just, it never crossed my mind. I was busy just raising kids. You know, so when the question was asked, I was like, sure, you know, I can handle living in an old house. You know, and I thought I was answering that question fairly honestly at that point.
But you were a skeptic.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, I think I was, you know, I think I'm more skeptical now after doing this for so long than I was at that point. You know, the thing is I didn't know. I would find, well, the best way to describe that is I would find reactions to things. My reactions would be along the lines of trying to make sense of the senseless, you know. The kids are having nightmares. Well, the kids are having nightmares. Why are they having nightmares? Well, maybe that move was too much on them. Maybe they expected something else to be a bigger change in our lives than it was. Or was it the divorce that was weighing on them? You see, I was constantly rationalizing and trying to put sense to the senseless. It's how I dealt with things. So I don't know if I would really call that skeptic, you know, other than I think it was a very human response to things and things that we don't understand. We try to put it into a box of understanding that meets our own. And I think that's what I was trying to do.
So you look at it, you get this strange meeting with this lady.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly thereafter, you get the phone call, and she's very, very excited to tell you the house is yours. Let's get this deal done quick. Red flag?
Yeah. No, it wasn't a red flag at all. I just figured she wanted to rent it. Here is the red flag, though. There is one right away here. Is when she wanted to meet, we had to meet at, it was a restaurant, and it was a fast food restaurant, and it was miles away from the house, by the way. And I thought that was strange. She always used the excuse that she didn't like to be there at night, that she couldn't drive at night, that sort of thing. But it was very strange. I thought it was really strange because here I am getting ready to sign for this house, and I'm thinking, you know, why aren't we in it? And then I got told that we would do a walkthrough, but the walkthrough had to be done during the daylight. It couldn't be done in the later evening because she was afraid to drive at night. You know, which the walkthrough turned out to be a very interesting thing. Now, this is the red flag. We were in the house, and we were searching, you know, through different things, and she was showing me the blinds and such, and, you know, we were doing the walkthrough. You bet you do it for anything, Ty, you rent anything. But at one point, the ice maker downstairs dropped ice. And she came out of her skin. I mean, she literally, I mean, she went white. She jumped. She screamed. And I'm looking at her reaction. And, you know, instantly I looked at her and I said it was the ice maker downstairs. I mean, I knew exactly what it was. And that's when she said something that this is the red flag. Especially hindsight's 20/20 looking back at it. She looked at me and she said, well, you don't believe in ghosts, Mr. LaChance, do you? And I said, well, no, of course I don't. And she said, well, let me tell you, she goes, I've never heard of anything about this house being haunted or anything.
You know? Oh, yeah?
So, yeah, that's kind of a red flag. If I would say there was any, there was others. I remember moving into the day we moved into the house, and we were unpacking the truck, and a car drove by very slowly. They rolled down the window, and they said, and it wasn't nicely how they said it. They said it pretty seriously, and they said, we hope you get along well here. Pulled up the window and drove away.
And even your daughter was like, that was weird.
Yeah, she did. She looked at me and she said, you know, Dad, that was strange. And I looked at her, you know, and with the kid, you don't make a big deal about anything. I mean, that's what you do. And I, And I kind of laughed when I said it to her. I said, well, you know, it was just nice neighbors. They're just welcoming us to the neighborhood. But it kind of stuck with me because I was like, well, that was kind of strange. You know, it's those moments when you know something is not right, you know, at that instant, but you don't know what it is, and you try to deny it. I mean, there's a sense of deniability that comes in when play with this as well.
Passersby avoided the house?
They used to have. That was bizarre. My daughter came in and got me one evening. She said, you need to come on out. And I said, why? She goes, I want to show you something. And she was all excited, you know. It was sort of a game, and I'll explain that to you. She said that, you know, watch the people as they come down the street. Well, it was summer, so people were out. And when they would walk up to the house, they would not walk in front of it. They would cross the street and walk the other way. And it was everybody. And she's like, watch, this has been going on all evening. She, you know, she was watching it. And it almost became a game. Will they walk in front of the house or will they cross the street? And they would always cross the street. And at one point, I even remember waving to someone and saying hello, and they ignored me. And I thought that was really weird.
Now, I've talked to many people who have claimed that we lived in a haunted house, our house was possessed, we had to do the whole exorcism, and oftentimes they will say, well, you know, we moved in, and it was a little weird, but it was pleasant, and we slept there, we spent weeks there, we spent months there, there would be like one weird thing here, one weird thing there. And then it was a while before the big escalation occurred. And
it was immediate for us.
Yes, that was not the case with you. It was day one, I believe.
It started immediately. You know, it really did. Everything from, I had a picture of angels I was trying to hang on a wall. My daughter did our decorating, or else it would have been Nintendo and beer posters, probably. So she wanted this picture hung of angels, and I went to hang them on the wall. And every time I would hang it on the wall, it would drop to the floor. And I would check the nail and everything was in place. But every time I would hang it up and start to walk away, it would be on the floor. And the last time this happens, I started to walk away, and I felt a whoosh of air. And it hit me in the calves. And I thought that was strange. Plus, you had the stuff going on outside. Then there were hot and cold spots. I thought I had I thought I had some electrical problems or air conditioning problems at one point. We would come home to find all the lights in the house on. And I'm not talking, when I'm saying all the lights, I'm not talking like there was a living room light or a kitchen light. I'm talking about you would come home and it would just be everything on. At that point I asked my dad, I said, well, you know, I'm coming home and I'm finding this stuff and it's kind of strange. And he said, well, you know, it's your imagination. He goes, what you need to do? He goes, I'll tell you what it is. All you kids, when you were little, you used to walk by light switches, and every light switch you would walk by, you would flip on. He goes, tell you what you do. He goes, you put all the kids in the car in the morning, go back through the house, make sure everything's off, get in the car. And he goes, and I guarantee you when you come home, you know, you'll find that there's no lights on. So I did that. I put the kids in the car and I went through the house. I checked everything to make sure all the lights were off. That night when we came home, every light in the house was on again. I went in the house. I thought, well, you know, at that point, I thought somebody was breaking in. I called the landlord. I talked to her. I said, you know, I came home, all the lights are on. Did you have a workman in here or something that I didn't know about? And she said at that point, well, no, I have to give you 24 hours notice before I come in. And I said, well, something's going on here. And it stayed like that. And then the children started reacting. The best way to describe, I mean, one of the first things with the children were my youngest son. And we were doing yard work outside in the yard, which was a big deal, by the way. I mean, if you lived in an apartment, you know, all of a sudden you have this yard, you're wanting to take care of it, at least for a little while until they realize it's work. But we were outside and we were working, and I sent my son inside to get a garden hose. And I heard him screaming from inside, and I ran in. I thought he was hurt. And I found him in the kitchen. He was standing in the middle of the kitchen floor. He was white. He was shaking. And I asked him what was wrong, and he said something. It chased him up the basement steps. Now, of course, you know, Mr. Rationalization kicked in. And it was like, you know, this is all kids go through this sort of thing, you know. And so I told him, I said, well, you know, that's your imagination. Everybody experiences this. And, you know, we'll go down there and there's nothing there. And I'll show you. And he didn't want to go. He refused. And so I did the dad thing. I opened the basement door and I walked down the steps and I was stomped. You know, nothing here, nothing there. And the truth is, I found nothing in the basement that day. Yeah, but every time he was out of arm's reach from that moment on, I would find him screaming and in that state, shaking. And then all of a sudden, we were sleeping in one room downstairs, me and the boys, because I was ordering their beds, and they hadn't arrived yet. I mean, this is fairly early on in staying there within the first couple days, really. And my daughter was sleeping upstairs, and she came down, and she said, I can't sleep. There's boxes moving around up there. I hear people talking, and my closet door won't stay closed. And she asked if she could sleep with us. So here I am. I have three kids in the bed with me, and I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? And I thought, well, and that's the point when I started thinking, well, maybe it's because of the divorce. Maybe it's because we are living, this isn't what they expected it to be. You know, everything I could think of. Paranormal wasn't one of them at that point. It was a little bit later when things happened, and I actually saw it for the first time.
Now, besides all of the sounds and everything like that, I want to talk a little bit about the smells, as we'll talk about later on. I mean, there was a terrible, terrible smell associated with this, but there was also the smell.
A moving smell. Moving smell. It wasn't just you just wouldn't smell. It would move.
Sure, sure. But the other smell that you mentioned was that of chocolate chip cookies. Mm-hmm. Or just cookies of some sort, I guess. And It seems so benign. How often, was this just that one time that you smelled the chocolate chip cookies, or was this a regular occurrence?
I think I smelled it like two or three times, but the first time I smelled it was the first time we walked into the house.
And I'm sure you thought nothing of it then, because granted, she could have just made
nothing.
Cookies.
Well, you know what I thought? I thought, you know, this is a smart real estate person, you know. They're trying to make it feel homey. You know, that's what I thought it was. I thought they were trying to make you feel like, you know, like you want to be there. You know, that's the scent of home in a way. So I didn't really put any credence to it at that point. There were times that I smelled it later. The other smell, however, that was horrible. You're talking about, I mean, if you could take the smells of soured milk and the smell of something dead and mix it together, you're probably close to what it smelled like. And it would move. I mean, you could actually follow it.
Now, the first, I guess, manifestation that you noticed, I mean, your son claimed that he'd been pushed up the stairs or whatever. So, I mean, he felt that, but you weren't there. Was it when you began to notice that, man, there's some massive temperature changes going on right here?
Right. And not only that, there was one night that the temperature, where you could actually watch it go up and down. You know, but there was one night in combination with it that I felt, I don't know how to describe it other than it was an electrical type charge feeling. But it was really strange. It's like it worked for its way from the inside outward. And I thought, well, this is serious this is serious electrical problems. And that's when I had my dad come. And my dad, you know, he was a contractor for all those years. So I had him come check the house out because I seriously thought that I was dealing with something more electrical, you know, all the lights. This and that, you know, the temperature changes. Now this electrical feeling. And he could find nothing wrong. The only thing he found wrong in the house was the box in the basement, the electrical box in the basement, didn't have a door on it. But other than that, he found nothing else wrong. Nothing to explain the type of things that were occurring.
So the first time you saw something, you looked up in a doorway and there was a figure. And the way you describe it is, it's a solid figure, but it seemed to have non-solid properties. I guess you would be the best person to explain this.
Right. It was, I'll tell you the story to it, too. I was in the living room, and I was a corporate trainer at the time. I would travel, and I would leave town for a week or so, and the kids would stay at my parents when that happened. But the night before, I always went out of the town. I always turned the television off, video games off, that sort of thing, and we always did something as a family. That particular night, we were going to play a game. And it was a Monopoly game is what it was, and the kids were getting Monopoly ready. And I was sitting on the kitchen, the living room couch, and there was the coffee table in front of me where the kids were getting the game ready. And I could see into the family room, and I could see the kitchen doorway. And when I looked up into the kitchen doorway, I saw this figure of a smoke. It was the best way I can describe it. Think of smoke, but it was solid in form, but it was fluid, and that's why I say smoky, because it was churning almost with inside itself. So when I saw it the first time, I looked down and I thought, well, I'm going to look up and this thing's not going to be there. And, tried to talk myself into being imagination. And when I looked back up into the doorway, it was still there. It moved into the family room in front of me, and it dissipated away pretty quickly. And it was gone. And at that point, my belief system completely crashed. I mean, I had to deal with what I had just seen, what I was going to do, how I was going to deal with it, obviously with the kids going through what they were going through. And I also remember thinking I didn't want to be like the families in the movies running out and screaming in the middle of the night. So I tried to do it calmly, and I had my keys on that table in front of me, and I took my keys and I stood up into my hand. Now, my daughter, who's 27 now, she said, I knew something was wrong with you, Dad, when I saw your right hand. And this was much later, she said. And she said, it was shaking. And I looked at him and I said, well, let's go get a soda and we'll go to Grandma's house. And they were quite surprised by that because it's like 9 o'clock at night. And they finally agreed to go. And we went to the door, and it was an old house, and you had to put the key into the lock on the outside. So when I closed the door and I put the key into the lock and started to turn it, the house started screaming. And it was a man scream. The kids heard it the same time I did. The dogs in the neighborhood started barking. The best way I can describe it to you is to think of somebody being hurt. It was an agonizing scream. And obviously we were running at that point, and we got out. And as we were driving away, though, my youngest son was looking out the window, and he said, Dad, look, it's standing in the window. That's the thing that I saw. And I looked turned around and looked, because there was two windows above the door. It was a two-story house. And I could see this thing standing in the window as I was driving away. So I wasn't quite sure how I was going to handle it from that point on.
I have never lived in a haunted house, and again, I've interviewed many people who have, and one of the things that always, and granted, like I said, it's never happened to me, and maybe if it happened to me, I would react differently, but as a person sitting here interviewing you and of interviewing others, my first thought when I hear a story like that is, if this happened to me, I am out of here, and I am never coming back, and invariably, everybody goes back. Now, granted, when you went back, it was, okay, it seems to me it was like, we're going to give you one more chance. If this happens again, we're out of here forever, which is kind of...
It's pretty much what it was.
Exactly. But some people go back and they stay there for months.
You know what?
Some people go and stay for like months and years afterwards.
No. Not me. No. But, at the same time, I was, you got to think about it this way. And I do understand that to an extent, especially if you bought the place. Because, you just spent all this money for this move. It's not easy and cheap to move, even if you buy or even if you rent. And that was the thing. And it was like, you know, in never before experiencing anything like this in my life, I thought, well, you know, I'll give it one more chance. Exactly. You know, the chances of this happening again are small. I'm not going to just run away from this house because, you know, I had something strange happen. Strange things happen to other people all the time. You know, that sort of thing. So I rationalized myself back into it. With the understanding that we'll give it one more try. And that was a difficult thing to do, by the way. I really had to do some thinking. And I was out of town all week. I was in Indianapolis. And I remember spending the nights in the hotel room. And that's all I would do was sit there and think about it, you know? You know, so when I got back into St. Louis on Saturday night, I went back home and I got the kids from my mom's house and we went back. And that's bothered me for a long time. Because at one point, one of the kids asked me if it was going to be okay. And I told him it wasn't.
Mm. Well, you didn't know.
No, I didn't.
This was not a lie. This was, oops, it's not going to be okay.
Right.
So you go back, and if I recall correctly, the first weekend was fine. Everybody was on edge, but it was fine. Is that right?
Right. It was. Everybody was doing quite well. Things seemed to be going okay. It was a long weekend. It was a holiday weekend too. I remember that. And you know, it started. Friday night was fine. Actually, wasn't. We didn't make it through the entire weekend. Saturday night was fine, and Saturday day was fine. Something strange happened Saturday that I looking back now, I remember, but we went to bed at 10 o'clock Saturday night. Now, the kids, I had to get them up and get them ready for Sunday school on Sunday mornings. So we would get up, and they had to be at Sunday school. It was like 7, and 7:15 is what Sunday school was. So I would get them up around 5:30, because getting three kids ready is a nightmare. So we went to bed at 10, and the next day I woke up and I looked at the clock and it was 5:35, and I got the kids up to get ready to go to Sunday school, getting them ready, and I noticed the light on the clock and it was 5:35 in the evening. And that was strange, because if you have three kids, you understand that if you the chances of kids sleeping that long, all of us, at any given time, without waking up and moving is pretty outrageous. So I don't know if anything happened during that time. Obviously, we were out, and I don't actually want to know. But we went to my parents' house that evening for dinner, and we did. And if you ever read the book, there's a long, I explained that going to dinner and stuff is kind of funny because my mom sent food home with my youngest son and he ate it in the car because he was always eating.
Oh, yeah.
When we got home, the kids went into the bedroom, and the bedroom was downstairs. And my room was downstairs on the same floor. There was a door that went into the living room, and there was a door that went, it was at the bottom of the steps near the bathroom. He had two doors to it. And the kids were in there playing, and the doors were open. And I remember my mother called me, and I was talking to her on the phone. And she was calling, obviously, to find out if we were okay, if everything was all right, you know, that sort of thing. And I remember at that point hearing the door shake. And it wasn't just like one door shook. It was like all of the doors shook at once. And actually, I kind of, you know, rationalization, Stephen kicked in again, and I'm thinking, well, boys are out playing, and so I told him to cut it out, and the door shook again, and I said, cut it out, and it almost was like the proverbial scary movie at that point, because every time I would say, stop it, it would do it louder. My mom asked me what was going on, and I said, the boys are out playing, and I'm telling them to, you know, to cool it down. And at that point, my daughter says to me from the bedroom, she says, I'm in here, Dad. My brothers are asleep. What's going on? And at that point, both those bedroom doors slammed shut. The house started, there was a shaking to it, a rumble, the best way I can describe it. There was a loud booming kind of sound going on. there was screaming going on. It was the man screaming. Now, if you talk to my daughter, she'll tell you that on the other side of that bedroom door, there was something else happening. She was hearing more than just one voice. I went to the door. It was through the phone, as a matter of fact. And I ran to the door, and I went to open, and I went to the door that was connected to the living room. It was the closest one to me. And when I tried to open the door, it wouldn't open. And so I started throwing my body against the door. Obviously, I could hear my child screaming on the other side of the door. And it was like throwing my body against a concrete wall. And after it was all over, I was bruised from head to toe on that side. But at one point, he said, God, help me. The door gave way. The boys were stirring, were waking up because they had been asleep. And I told them to go out the front door. And then when I got to my daughter, she was in shock, and I had to grab her. And as I'm running out the bedroom, that other door that had remained closed slammed open, and there was something on my feet. I never turned around to see what it was.
And that was the end of that house for the children?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My mother would never have let me brought him back in after that.
Sure.
For one. It was really disturbing. I mean, all of a sudden we were homeless. I mean, we couldn't live in it. And, you know, the thing was because of their safety. I mean, just, you know, not even just their physical safety, but for their mental safety, you know, the psychological aspects of what could be happening to them within it all was too much. It was too much, and that's when I took him out of there for good.
So all in all, you lived there for only about a week.
Well, it was 13 days total.
13 days.
13 days total. I actually was in possession of it for 3 months. To give you an idea, so I was living in a house we lived 13 days in, and the rest of it, 3 months, it sat vacant. And I was paying for it. And the landlord said that we had to sublease it in some way. And I said, well, if I have to do that, I said, you know, one thing that you can't do is put children in this house again. Oh, no, we won't get children. Well, she called me one afternoon to tell me that she had found someone to rent the house. It was supposedly a cousin of hers. And the first thing I asked, they don't have children. Oh, no, they don't have children. But the day that I went to move out, the last moment as I'm walking out the house and locking the door, I turn around and a car drives up and two small children get out of the back seat. She had lied to me.
And you...
And, you know, at that point, you know, I still kind of feel guilty about that a little bit.
Ultimately, I mean, you eventually had a talk with the landlady and you got it out of her after a while that...
Right.
The stuff was going on. And after you left, and you could tell more of the story, I mean, after you were gone, she continued to rent out this house. At one point, you actually saw people fleeing from the house. I guess just kind of talk about the future.
With police coming.
Police showing
up. More than just fleeing. I mean, these people were running out of the place in their pajamas, and the police cars were pulling up with lights on.
Now, do you have any information on, like, what the police discovered? What kind of investigations were done in the house? I know that the house is no longer, I mean, it's there, but it's a kennel or something?
Well, at one point she tried to make it a dog kennel, but the city wouldn't let her. She's renting it out.
Oh, she's still renting it out?
She's still renting it out.
Wow. I was unaware of that.
Yeah. And, you know, what happened was the city, she went in and was trying to make it a dog kennel. I mean, the city wouldn't let her do that. And so, you know, unfortunately, yeah, that's the case. Knowing that and seeing the families come and go, even the family that moved in directly after us didn't last for very long. And then, of course, when, you know, people started hearing about it, people that had lived there before, the family that lived there directly before we did, he came forward to talk to me one day, and he started crying when he was talking to me, describing what happened to him, because he would wake up in the morning and find bite marks up his calf. And so, you know, they moved out, obviously. So,
yeah.
The different stories that have come out, this place was going for quite a while, and there were numerous families that were affected during those times. However, you know, the family that's living there at the moment seems to be doing okay, which is kind of strange. It's the first family in years that has been able to stay there for any length of time.
Is there anything that you're aware of that happened? Did they call somebody in to do something?
No.
Or?
Well, you know, we did quite a few. There was quite a few prayers and such. At a point, the house was blessed and stuff. Well, the blessing was not the greatest, but obviously. But I just hope that maybe something stuck somewhere, that maybe somebody did something to help, but they seem to be doing okay. Sometimes these things will calm down. We don't know why they calm down. But, you know, it's the whole point of everything that I did was that either somebody could live there and live there safely or they wouldn't move there at all. But so if they're living there well, God bless them.
What sort of investigations have been done over the years into the house? What kind of evidence? Is there any good evidence that has been pulled up?
Yeah, I mean, you pull it up on the internet, it's all over the place. Just put in the Union Screaming House and you'll find it. Or Union Missouri Haunting, anything like that, and it seems to come up. There are quite a few investigators. When I left the house, you know, I went back in 2004 when a family moved into the house and she contacted me. Well, actually, it was a friend went looking for the house, and she said, well, can I go take pictures of it, which I thought was kind of strange, you know. But I was like, yeah, I don't think that would be a problem. You know, you can go, and this is where it is. And she called me and said, well, you know, I was looking for the house, and I got lost. And so there was a woman standing in the yard with two kids, and I went up to her, and I said, I'm looking for this house. And she kind of laughed. She said, I looked at her and said, I'm looking for a haunted house in the neighborhood. And that's when the lady living there said, "That's you're talking about my house, and it's very haunted." And so my friend told her about me, and this woman ended up calling me. We actually became really, really good friends for pretty quickly. I was going through a lot afterwards, you know, and there was a certain amount of activity that followed us and followed me. And I was having this same nightmare that would run. I would have it, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week, and it was always the same nightmare. So when she came to me and she started talking to me, we decided that we would try to find find some help, not only for her family, but also for what I was going through as well, which I thought was a pretty good thing. So a lot of the investigations that went on afterward and people coming in and out, we were looking for help. It seems like nobody would help us. And I remember at one point we were sitting on the porch at one point and she looked at me and she was crying when she said this. And she said, you know, we could find anybody to come in this house in 10 minutes. They're going to tell you it's haunted. In 10 minutes, they're going to realize we're going through something, but not one of them seems to be able to tell us how to take care of it. And so that's when we decided that we would try to figure that out on our own. And probably the biggest mistake we ever made, we started looking for help. First form of real help that came through, we got an investigator who's actually is the psychic and investigator from the Lent Mansion here in St. Louis, which is considered one of the most haunted. It seemed to me, you know, it's considered, Life Magazine called it one of the most haunted places in America. So if you're going to go look for a haunted, you help for a haunted, you go to the place that's the most haunted, right?
Sure.
But she came in and she, all kinds of things happened. She got thrown against the wall. I mean, literally thrown against the wall. But she came to us and she said, well, it's haunted. This is what I think it is. But I can't tell you to move out of it. And, you know, I can't tell you, you know, how else you're going to get help for this. And so it was very disconcerting in that sense, too. And I mean, so we tried everything. I mean, you know, there was one guy that would only call me at 3 o'clock in the morning because come to find out he called himself a psychic vampire. I mean, you know, every sort of bad thing we could go through. They come in, they grab evidence, they go and say, well, we'll get back to you. And the next thing we know, we would see it out on the internet. We'd never hear from them again. So, you know, the first form of real help, though, came from Lorraine Warren. I gave Lorraine a call. I actually went through Tony first. And I told Tony about it, and he connected us with Lorraine. And Lorraine instantly, and that was the first time I heard the word demonic use, was Lorraine was like, you know, you guys under, this is a demonic haunting, you're under a demonic influence, this is what you need to do. And what she told us to do was to go and get a priest to come in to bless it. She told us everything the priest was supposed to do. We were supposed to clean the house before, all the cabinets and doors were supposed to be open, that sort of thing. And so the priest comes that night, and he starts to bless the house, but he's not blessing everything. And he's going really fast, and he looks really nervous. And as a matter of fact, he tried to go without blessing the basement, and I kind of made him do that. And so at one point, you know, he leaves, and I'm looking out the window. We're watching him. He's practically run into his car, and the pounding starts upstairs again. You know, almost like it was telling us it didn't work. So we called Lorraine back, and we said, well, that didn't work. You know, we explained to her just what I explained to you. And Lorraine said, well, you got the wrong priest. And, you know, this was a small town. It was like, well, we're going to find another priest. I actually, at that point, I met John. And John started helping me and directing me in different areas. However, but we finally did get to a priest, a good priest, who had done this sort of thing before. As a matter of fact, he even brought in an exorcist from the Vatican at one point to talk to us and help us. However, things blew up to mammoth proportions before that could ever be done.
So you got an actual Vatican exorcist to come and investigate. So they must have...
He never could step foot in the house. He never. We were setting that up to get all that done when everything went haywire.
And what went wrong that he was unable to even get inside the house?
Well, one morning, Linda, who's Helen in the book, by the way, she called me and she said that she had basically been raped by this thing. And she had been hurt. She had bite marks on her. When I got there, you know, she always wanted me to tell people it's not like the TV show where she's in the corner in her nightgown like a cracked out woman. But, you know, she was sitting there, but there was something very wrong with her. She was marked up. She had around her neck. She was bruised around her neck where they tried choking her. She had bite marks up her arms. She wasn't in a very good state at all. And so I got her out of the house, and, you know, first thing I was going to do, I needed to get her some help. So we were headed to the hospital, and it was in the hospital that it all really started coming out. We were talking, and they asked her if she was homicidal. She said yes. They asked her if she was suicidal. She said yes. And so they kept her. Her blood pressure at the point when we got there was very, very low. It was, you know, if I remember, it was 200 over something, you know, I mean, just outrageous. And her pulse was only at, it was 204 over 198. That's what it was. And her pulse was 45 at that point. And during the point when we were there, her pulse dropped to 35. I mean, the nurse even looked at me and said, my God, we don't get this under control. We could lose her. But she was sitting there and she was talking like nothing was wrong. It was very strange. So they kept her, and that was when she never went back to the house. And so the house went back into the hands of the landlord, obviously, and that was the point when we were trying. I thought I had her agreed to let them come in to finish the work that we were going to do. And one afternoon, I got an email from her that said she had rented the house. And the email's pretty disturbing. It said, I can hear the children running around upstairs. I can hear their little angel screams. I hope the guardian angel watches over them tonight.
Not good.
And that was the last I heard from her.
So the book, The Uninvited, The True Story of the Union Screaming House, has got the entire story. At least up through September of 2008 when it was published.
Right.
And I know that you've got some other projects as well, so I want to get into some of those here. Blessed Are the Wicked, which just came out last year, which I presume has... I guess, what part of the story is in which book?
Okay, well, the first book goes to 2005, 2008, when I wrote it. And Blessed Are the Wicked really takes up from 2005 on. I thought it was, you know, I had people asking me to, you know, write the other side of it. And I thought, well, you know, at first I was kind of resistant to it. But then I thought, you know, there's a lot of people out there that live there. And one of the things that people misunderstand about a haunting is that once you close the door and walk away, it's over. And it very rarely ever is. It doesn't work that way. And especially when you're dealing with something, whether you want to call it diabolic, whether you want to call it evil, whether you want to call it negative, I'm not much into the labels of it. But there's a lot of things that happen to you, and it still tries to affect your life from time to time. And I thought that was an important story to tell. And then also the other side of that, too, is how do you deal with life after going through something like that and trying to come back to normal?
Sure.
I thought it was interesting that no one has ever told that side of it. So Blessed Are the Wicked was that side of it, in that aftermath, you know. And I think I even say in the book at one point, you know, the aftershocks are sometimes much more damaging than the earthquake itself. So.
And are things largely back to normal today?
Yeah, really. I mean, things are really good. They really are. You know, 2011, I went through a heart surgery. During that point of the heart surgery, I died. and I don't have no fantastic story to tell you about the death part of it. Other than the fact that after that, from that point on, things were good. I mean, I've talked to some people who think that maybe the attachment part of what I was going through was disconnected at the point of death. Which is possible. That makes logical sense to me in some ways, if you can make logic out of any of this. But things are good now. They're pretty stable. I'm back to a normal life, but it took 10 years to get there. So I'm glad to finally be, you know, it's like waking up from a bad, bad dream. So there was some adjustment and there was some dealing with those feelings. But all in all, things are good.
Blessed Are the Wicked, the terrifying sequel to The Uninvited, as well as the original, The Uninvited, the true story of the Union Screaming House, Stephen LaChance. And before we go, I want to give you a chance to plug anything else you've got, if you've got websites, social media, anything like that, or just direct people to Amazon.
Well, you can go to, I have an author Facebook page on Facebook, and I have a Facebook page. You can go to my website, which is StephenLaChance.com. Any of the books are available at Amazon, Kindle, Nook, Barnes & Noble, BAM, anywhere books are sold or downloaded, around the world, actually. You can get them anywhere. You know, and the next book is going to be an interesting one, and I'm excited about that. It's called Where the Devil Played, and it's based on the 1949 St. Louis exorcism case, which we have seen a lot about recently. I've been writing this book for 2 years. And I can't wait to tell the story and share the truth behind that case. So that'll be coming out next year. So we're just finishing it up now. So I'm pretty excited about that. And then also A Haunting, and if you can catch Fear House on Destination America on A Haunting, that runs quite often. And then there will be a new A Haunting coming up about one of the cases I went to help a family with. That you'll see coming up in the near future. So that's everything's going really, really well. I continue to try to help people. If anybody out there needs any sort of help or has any questions, always feel free to go to the website, hit the contact tab, and let me know. I'm here to help those that went through, that are going through what I went through. It helps.
Stephen LaChance is our guest, and Stephen, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and hopefully down the road we can do this again. You got new projects coming out, maybe in association with those. But I do appreciate it, and best of luck with everything, and we'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here for the final segment of the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Want to thank everybody for listening here tonight. It was a different show than usual. My Sunday schedule has been very packed, and so in the future, sometimes we're going to have live shows, sometimes we'll do open lines, and sometimes, like this week, we'll have a pre-packaged show, much like the one we did today. If you really enjoyed the show, let me know. I tried some different things in terms of the news segment. My email address, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. And obviously, before we go, I want to direct everybody to afterdarkradioshow.com, which is our website. If you head up here right now to afterdarkradioshow.com, you can grab last week's program. Every show that we do is available for a full week as a free download up at afterdarkradioshow.com. So if you head up there right now, you can grab last week's show. Otherwise, if you're not listening live on Sunday night, you will see this show available as a free download. Once again, it's a free MP3, so if you have friends who love this subject, make sure you drop them a line, tell them about the After Dark Radio Show, afterdarkradioshow.com, and of course, the Dark Matter Digital Network. The 9 Pacific Midnight Eastern time slot, Monday through Friday, is the Art Bell time slot. Midnight in the Desert, Monday through Friday, available free via TuneIn Radio whenever the show is live. You can sign up as a time traveler to grab podcasts. After the fact, it is $7.99 a month, a great value for all of the programming you get with Art Bell every week on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Make sure you check out artbell.com for more information on how to sign up as a time traveler. And I want to thank everybody for listening again tonight. Thanks, of course, to Keith Rowland for making this all possible, the great Art Bell, and all of you, the listeners. We'll talk to you again next time. After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.